Hey guys, this right here is going to be PALS, the Pediatric Advanced Life Support. And the way it's going to go is I'm going to try to keep it in this order. The systematic approach to the pediatric patients, pediatric shock recognition, pediatric management of shock, recognizing respiratory distress, managing respiratory distress, recognizing cardiac arrest, management of cardiac arrest, arrhythmias, recognition of those arrhythmias, and then management of those arrhythmias. I don't remember PALS being this deep, but again, it's been almost 2 years since I've taken PALS, but it seems like it's a lot more in depth than just your normal ACLS. So this material is coming straight from the book for the course. Just make sure that you guys are reading that material because I did not add some stuff in there like team dynamics or resources for respiratory care or management of the post-cardiac arrest, you know, stuff like that. I didn't include that into this stuff. So if you guys need that or want that, then by all means, read the book or you know, Google it or whatever. But this right here is going to be the intro for the PALS stuff. So I hope you guys enjoy the Pediatric Advanced Life Support material for the course.
Patient's here. Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, there's definitely blood.
Well, he's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, or was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
She had 22 in her left hand.
For 45 minutes of CPR. No we can stop CPR.
6 over.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you're an ER nurse, or really any critical care professional getting ready for your PALS certification, then today's Deep Dive is absolutely for you.
Yeah, this is essential stuff.
We are jumping headfirst into, I think, the most foundational piece of pediatric advanced life support, arrhythmia recognition.
It really is. I mean, this is the single most crucial skill you can master. The PALS algorithms are, frankly, they're worthless if you can't accurately see the rhythm on the monitor and then connect that to the kid in the bed.
Right, to the physiological instability.
Exactly. So our mission today isn't just to, you know, review definitions from a textbook. We want to get into the clinical reasoning, the why behind unstable bradycardia and these really rapid tachycardias.
So you can actually anticipate the next steps in the algorithm before anyone even has to call them out.
That's the goal. That's when you know you've mastered it.
We've distilled a whole stack of foundational PALS sources, and they all drill down into the pathophysiology of these rhythms, giving you those nuanced characteristics you need to tell the difference.
The difference between a stable child who's just in distress and a child who is, you know, right on the brink of cardiopulmonary arrest.
This is basically your shortcut to mastering that rhythm recognition piece of the certification.
And the material we're drawing from, it specifically focuses on recognizing compromise, understanding those key ECG differentiators, especially, and this is the big one, mm-hmm. between sinus tach and SVT, and then, of course, classifying how severe a bradycardia is.
Mastering this is step one, the critical first step.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's unpack this, and I want to start right at the physiological core. Why is a child's heart rate so uniquely vulnerable? And why does a pediatric arrest look so different from what we usually see in adults?
That is the perfect place to start. And it all begins with a really simple equation for how we maintain hemodynamic stability. It's cardiac output.
Cardiac output.
Which is just the volume of blood the heart pumps out per minute. And you calculate it by taking stroke volume and multiplying it by heart rate.
And this simple equation, this is where kids' physiology just takes a sharp turn away from an adult's.
It really does.
Because as practitioners, you know, we're often dealing with adult codes, and we know if an adult's heart rate dips a little bit, the heart has this amazing ability to compensate. It can just increase its stroke volume.
Yeah, it just pumps harder. It pumps more blood with each contraction to keep that cardiac output stable.
But that flexibility,
yeah,
It just doesn't exist in infants and young children.
Not at all. And the sources are really clear on this. The young heart muscle, especially the ventricles, it's just less compliant. It can't stretch or contract with that same kind of force variability that an adult heart has.
So to put it simply, the stroke volume, the amount of blood they can eject with each beat, is pretty much fixed.
It's relatively fixed, yeah. Especially when they're in a volume-sensitive state like dehydration or shock.
Okay, so if stroke volume is off the table, the body really only has one major tool left in the toolbox to control cardiac output and meet the body's demands.
Exactly, heart rate. It becomes the primary, essential, and frankly, often the only determinant of cardiac output in infants and young children. Which means any deviation from that normal, age-appropriate heart rate range, whether it's too slow, bradycardia, or too fast, tachycardia, it's going to rapidly result in a critically low cardiac output.
That one physiological constraint, it just underscores why rate control is the intervention that buys you the most time in a pediatric resuscitation.
It is. If you can fix the rate, you often fix the output. It's that simple and that critical.
And that distinction, that total dependence on heart rate, it immediately tells us why a profound bradycardia in an infant is so much more catastrophic, so much faster than it would be in an adult.
Absolutely. And that catastrophic drop in output, that leads us right to our next critical concept, which is defining cardiopulmonary compromise.
Right. Because an abnormal rhythm is one thing. It's a flag.
But compromise.
Compromise is the siren. It's the thing screaming for you to intervene right now. And your ability to spot that compromise, that's what dictates whether you have 10 minutes to figure things out or 10 seconds to act. So how do the PELLS guidelines, based on these sources, how do they define that critical state where poor output is actually leading to organ failure?
It's defined by the presence of three major criteria, which are really, I mean, they're the clinical signs of shock. First, you're looking for hypotension.
So a blood pressure that's below the normal threshold for that child's age.
Correct. Second, acutely altered mental status. This could be a decreased level of consciousness, lethargy, or in an infant, that severe persistent irritability.
Okay. And the third?
And third, you're looking for definitive signs of shock, so clear evidence of poor end organ perfusion.
Let's focus on those signs of shock for a second, because for an ER nurse, these are often the first things you can put your hands on. They tell the story before the monitor even spits out the full rhythm.
You're absolutely right. Poor end organ perfusion, it shows up as a whole cascade of clinical signs. You're looking for cool, clammy extremities. You're checking for a delayed cap refill time.
1 to 3 seconds.
Greater than 3 seconds, yeah. You're feeling for weak or thready peripheral pulses compared to their central pulses, like the femoral. You're looking for modeling of the skin, diaphoresis.
Which is that excessive sweating you see when their sympathetic tone is just cranked way up.
Exactly.
And what about the more subtle behavioral signs,
mm-hmm.
especially in kids who can't talk to you?
That's where it gets really tricky, and it takes experience. In an infant, compromise might just look like profound irritability.
Yeah.
Or they're not feeding well, or they're just unusually sleepy.
Okay.
In older kids, you might hear them complain about a vague feeling of discomfort or chest pain, dizziness, or you might just see a sudden change in how they're breathing, you know, leading to respiratory distress.
So if you see any of those clinical signs and you pair them with an abnormal heart rate on the monitor,
you are dealing with an unstable arrhythmia and you have to move straight to intervention.
Yeah.
You have to assess the rhythm and the perfusion together, always.
So the real challenge for the nurse is to recognize that that early irritability or that decreased responsiveness physiologically, that's shock until you prove it's not. You can't separate the rhythm strip from the child in the bed.
You can't. They're two parts of the same story.
Okay, let's shift our focus now to the slow rates. Let's dig into bradycardia. What exactly constitutes bradycardia in the PALS world?
Well, the simple definition is a heart rate that's slow relative to the child's age, their level of activity, and this is the key part, their clinical condition.
But the rhythm that really demands our immediate attention is systematic bradycardia.
That's the one. Let's be really precise about that definition.
Please.
It's a heart rate that is slower than the normal range for that child's age. And usually we're talking about a rate that is persistently less than 60 beats per minute. That is also accompanied by those signs of cardiopulmonary compromise we just talked about.
And the prognosis for this rhythm, I mean, it's grim if you turn it around immediately.
It's classified as an ominous sign of impending cardiac arrest. I mean, if that heart rate drops below 60 and you've got poor perfusion and that slow rate is sticking around despite you giving them good oxygenation and ventilation,
then the guidelines say you start CPR.
You have to. you initiate chest compressions immediately. That rhythm tells you that the child's compensatory mechanisms have failed. Their cardiac output just isn't sustainable anymore.
So we need to understand the why. Why does a kid's heart slow down to this critical pre-arrest level?
The why is, overwhelmingly, one thing. Tissue hypoxia.
Okay.
Progressive hypoxemia, or respiratory failure, is the number one cause of symptomatic bradycardia in children. And this is a huge differentiator from adults, where bradycardia is often an intrinsic electrical problem.
Right, primary heart disease.
In kids, the slow heart rate is usually a physiological consequence of them not being able to breathe effectively.
Which means, from a management standpoint, our first move is always respiratory. As the nurse, you're not reaching for atropine first.
No, you're not.
You're securing the airway and you're maximizing ventilation.
Exactly. Your absolute priority is to provide adequate oxygenation and ventilation because you're treating the underlying hypoxia that's causing that vagal response and the bradycardia. You treat the primary cause first.
And if you reverse the hypoxia?
The rate should climb right back to normal. If it doesn't, that's when you start suspecting a primary cardiac problem or some other profound secondary cause.
Okay, so let's use the source materials classification here to guide us through how to differentiate these causes quickly. Primary versus secondary bradycardia. Because this distinction, it directs the entire plan.
It does. So primary bradycardia or intrinsic bradycardia, it originates in the heart itself. This is from a congenital or an acquired heart condition that directly damages the conduction system.
The SA node, the AV node, the wiring.
All of it. The problem is structural or electrical, and it's inside the cardiac system.
What are some common examples of primary causes that we might see?
Things like congenital abnormalities that mess with the conduction system's integrity, surgical injury after a complex cardiac repair, or diseases like a severe cardiomyopathy or myocarditis.
So often, kids with a known complex medical history.
Very often, yes. Now, contrast that with secondary bradycardia. This is the one we see most often in the ER. It's a reflection of a systemic illness.
So it's not the heart's fault. Something else is making it slow down.
Exactly. Secondary bradycardia is caused by non-cardiac conditions that alter the normal electrical conduction, usually by depressing the SA or AV node. And this is where you have to immediately map that rhythm back to your H's and T's.
Okay, let's list them out. What are the H's and T's that are most relevant for a secondary bradycardia? Because this is the mental map the nurse needs to anticipate what labs to draw and what interventions to prep.
For sure. So the key secondary causes are hypoxia number one, always, it drives the rate down. Then hypothermia, which severely depresses the metabolic rate and nodal function.
Mm-hmm.
Hypotension, because that causes poor coronary perfusion, which just stresses the myocardium even more. Then you have hydrogen ion excess, which is acidosis.
Right.
Hypoglycemia, and then a big one, drugs or toxins, things like sedatives, opioids, digoxin, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers. As the nurse, if that rate is slow, you are proactively hunting for the source of one of these systemic problems.
Let's move to the monitor. Beyond just the slow rate, what are the ECG characteristics that help us pinpoint what's going on?
Okay, so first, obviously the rate is slow for their age. Now, P waves. They may or may not be visible. If you see them, it means the atria are firing, but they might be dissociated.
Meaning they don't lead to a QRS complex.
Right, and the QRS complex itself gives you a clue. It can be narrow or wide. A wide QRS in a bradycardia suggests the impulse is starting way down in the ventricles, like an escape rhythm, or there's a severe block plus a pre-existing bundle branch block. Either way, it's generally more ominous.
And that leads us right into the complexities of AV block classification. This is essential for the ER nurse to know, because it determines the severity of the conduction failure and how urgently you might need to start pacing.
It is. AV block is just a disturbance in conduction between the atria and the ventricles, and we divide it into 3 degrees of essentially progressive failure.
Let's start with the simplest, first-degree AV block.
First degree is purely an electrical delay. You have a constant but prolonged PR interval, so the signal gets through every single time. It's just a little bit slow going through the AV node.
And clinically, what does that mean for the patient?
Clinically, the sources all agree this is usually asymptomatic. It rarely requires treatment on its own. It's more of a finding.
What's causing that delay?
It's often just enhanced vagal tone, or it could be drug effects, digoxin, beta blockers, you know the list.
Okay.
It can also be an early sign of myocarditis. But often, if you just adjust the medication or correct some mild physiological issue, that PR interval shortens right back up.
Okay, so now we get to second degree Mobitz type I, also known as Venkebach. this block is happening a little higher up in the AV node itself.
Banka block has that classic pattern you learn. The PR interval gets progressively longer with each beat until finally one P wave is completely blocked. It just doesn't conduct to the ventricles.
And then the cycle repeats. Longer, longer, longer drop. Now you have a Venka block.
That's the one. Yeah. The key is that progressive PR lengthening.
And since this block is happening higher up at the AV node level, what are the clinical implications? Is it as dangerous?
It's generally less severe than a type 2 because the bundle branches, the lower wiring is usually fine. So the ventricular rate, while it's irregular, is often good enough to maintain perfusion.
So the patient might feel what? A little lightheaded?
Maybe some presyncope or lightheadedness, but rarely a full hemodynamic collapse. And the causes are often transient things, like drug effects or increased parasympathetic tone.
Okay, now let's contrast that immediately with second-degree Mobitz type 2. Why is type 2 so much more dangerous?
Mobitz type 2 is a much more serious problem, usually because it's happening lower down in the conduction system, like in the bundle of His or the bundle branches.
And here's the key distinction on the ECG.
The PR interval of the beats that do conduct remains constant. It doesn't lengthen. It's just that some P waves dot poof, they fail to conduct entirely, often in a fixed ratio, like a 2.1 or a 3.1 block.
And if the problem is lower down in the bundle branches, that means any subsequent block could lead straight to a complete heart block.
Precisely. Because the block is distal to the AV node, any escape rhythm that has to kick in is going to be slower, less reliable, and originate lower in the ventricle.
Which means a wider QRS.
A wider, slower, much less stable rhythm. This makes Mobitz type 2 inherently unstable. It's much more likely to cause syncope or rapidly progress to a third degree block.
So if you see a Mobitz 2, you're thinking about pacing much sooner.
Absolutely. You're getting the pads on, you're anticipating the need for external or transvenous pacing way sooner than you would for a type I.
And that brings us to the rhythm that requires immediate life support. Third degree, or a complete heart block.
This is a total electrical failure between the atria and the ventricles. There is absolutely no relationship between the P waves, which is your atrial activity, and the QRS complexes, your ventricular activity.
They're completely divorced.
Completely. The atria are firing at their own rate, and the ventricles are firing at theirs. They are totally independent.
Which leaves the ventricles relying on a very slow, very unreliable pacemaker.
Correct. The rhythm is maintained by a very slow, often wide ventricular escape rhythm. And this loss of coordination, this AV dissociation, and the profound drop in heart rate just cripples cardiac output.
Leading to severe symptoms.
Severe symptoms. Fatigue, syncope, shock. The causes are things like extensive conduction system disease, toxicity, or just persistent severe hypoxia and acidosis. This is a pacing emergency, no question.
Okay, we've established that slow rates kill cardiac output by not letting the heart fill enough times per minute. Now let's flip it and explore why excessively fast rates are equally catastrophic. Let's talk tachyarrhythmias.
Right. So tachycardia is just an abnormally fast heart rate for the child's age. And these rhythms, whether they start in the atria, the AV node, or the ventricles, they all risk acute cardiopulmonary compromise, especially if the child has some underlying cardiac issue.
Let's really reinforce the two main physiological reasons why going too fast is so bad. The sources break this down beautifully.
Okay, so first, and this is the big one, extremely rapid rates drastically shorten the duration of diastole.
Diastole is when the ventricles relax and fill up with blood for the next beat.
Exactly. If diastole is too short, ventricular filling is just inadequate. That crushes your stroke volume and therefore crushes your cardiac output.
Okay, so that's problem number one. What's the second?
Second, and this is so critical, coronary perfusion, the blood flow to the heart muscle itself, happens primarily during diastole.
So a prolonged, rapid tachycardia means the heart is literally starving itself of oxygen at the exact moment it's being asked to work its absolute hardest.
That's a perfect way to put it. It creates a severe myocardial oxygen demand supply mismatch. In kids, and especially infants, a prolonged SVT can rapidly just tire out the heart muscle, leading straight to myocardial dysfunction, congestive heart failure, and cardiogenic shock.
Which is why immediate rate control is absolutely paramount.
It is.
So our first step when we see a tachycardia on the monitor is to classify it by its QRS complex width.
Yep. We use a cutoff of 0.09 seconds. If the QRS is less than that, we call it narrow complex. That means the impulse originated above the ventricles and traveled down the normal fast highway, the bundle branches.
So that's things like sinus tachycardia, SVT, atrial flutter.
Correct. If the QRS is wider than 0.09 seconds, it's a wide complex rhythm. And that's generally either ventricular tachycardia, VT, or, and this is a critical distinction, an SVT with aberrant conduction.
Okay, let's start with the one that causes the most diagnostic headaches. Sinus tachycardia, ST. This is a physiologic response we have to rule out first.
We have to. Sinus tachycardia is a normal compensatory response. The SA node is firing faster because the body needs more cardiac output. There's a reason for it, like a fever or pain or fluid loss.
It's not a pathological arrhythmia. You don't treat it with antiarrhythmic drugs.
No. And misdiagnosing ST as SVT and giving the wrong drugs is one of the most common and dangerous pitfalls.
So as the ER nurse, what are the ECG keys that tell you this fast rhythm is just ST?
You have to look for beat-to-beat variability. The rate should fluctuate. It should change with activity, with pain, with crying, with stress. Right. And critically, the rate is usually constrained. There's a ceiling. It's generally less than 220 beats per minute in infants and less than 180 in children. And you absolutely must see normal P waves before every single QRS.
And the R to R interval, the space between the beats, is usually variable, not perfectly fixed.
Not fixed, right. It speeds up, it slows down, it's responding to the body.
So what are the common underlying causes we should be hunting for if we think it's ST?
Oh, the list is long. Fever is huge. Pain, anxiety, hypovolemia, either from dehydration or hemorrhage, shock, like septic or hypovolemic shock, hypoxemia, trauma. Your job with ST is to find and aggressively treat that underlying cause.
Give the fluids, give the Tylenol, fix the oxygenation problem.
Exactly. You treat the patient, not the monitor.
Okay, now let's turn to supraventricular tachycardia, SVT, the pathological rhythm that's the great mimicker of ST.
SVT is an abnormally fast rhythm that starts above the ventricles, and it's often caused by a reentry circuit. Think of it like a short circuit, often involving an accessory pathway or the AV node itself. And the hallmark of it is its paroxysmal nature.
Meaning it has an abrupt onset and an abrupt termination, like flipping a switch.
Exactly like flipping a switch on and then off.
So how does the ECG scream SVT at you, especially when there's hemodynamic compromise?
The signs are basically the inverse of what we see in ST. In SVT, there is NO beat-to-beat variability. The rate is fixed, and it is relentless. And it typically meets or blows past those critical rate thresholds.
The 220/180 rule.
Right. 220 per minute in infants or 0/180 per minute in children. P waves are often completely unidentifiable, or they're buried inside the QRS, and that RR interval is dead constant.
Those rate thresholds, the 220 and 180, those have to be the nurse's non-negotiable mental alarm bells. If a child crosses that line, you have to assume it's SVT until you can prove it's not.
You have to, because a rate that fast simply does not allow for adequate diastolic filling. Low cardiac output is guaranteed eventually.
Let's talk about the clinical presentation of SVT.
Yeah.
How do we spot that impending CHF or shock at the bedside?
You're looking for things like irritability, a refusal to feed, or just profound lethargy. And because that heart is getting so tired, you start to see signs of congestive heart failure.
So things like rapid breathing.
Rapid breathing, grunting. You might hear crackles when you listen to their lungs, hepatomegaly from fluid backing up. An older child might actually be able to tell you they feel severe palpitations or like they're going to pass out.
And prolonged SVT, even in a kid with a structurally normal heart, is a true medical emergency.
It absolutely is.
Okay, this brings us to the ST versus SVT quick comparison. This is the most common diagnostic hurdle in PELAS. We need to be able to apply that mental table really, really quickly.
Let's focus on the practical differences. Picture this. A child comes in, they're crying, they have a fever, heart rate is 190. When you finally get them settled down, the rate drops to 160. That rate variability.
That strongly suggests ST. It's responding to the stimulus.
Exactly. Now, same child, but they're quiet, they're limp, they look mottled, and the rate is a constant 230 beats per minute. There's no fluctuation, no visible P waves.
That fixed, relentless rate, plus the fact that it's over the threshold, tells us this has to be SVT.
And the clinical implication of getting that right is enormous. If you suspect ST, your first move is an IV fluid challenge and antipyretics.
But if you suspect SVT,
you are immediately preparing the synchronized tardioverter pads and drawing up adenosine. Getting it wrong wastes crucial time, or even worse, leads to giving the wrong drug or an unnecessary shock.
We should probably briefly touch on atrial flutter. It's another narrow complex rhythm, but we usually see it in specific populations, right?
We do. You typically see atrial flutter in kids who have pre-existing congenital heart disease or after they've had cardiac surgery. It's a rapid re-entry circuit, but it's contained within the atrium.
And the ECG hallmark is that classic.
Sawtooth pattern of P waves. The atrial rate is just incredibly fast, over 300 a minute, but the ventricular rate is usually slower because the AV node blocks some of those signals.
So you might get a 2.1 or a 4.1 block.
Right, which means the ventricular rate might actually be near normal or only mildly tachycardic, which can be deceiving.
Okay, now let's move to the most potentially unstable rhythms, the wide complex rhythms, starting with ventricular tachycardia.
VT. VT is, it's the definition of electrical inefficiency. The impulse is generated down in the ventricle, so it bypasses that super fast, specialized conduction system.
Which leads to those wide, bizarre-looking QRS complexes, wider than 0.09 seconds.
Yep. And the rate is usually at least 120, but often it gets up to 200 or even more.
And why does VT cause such immediate hemodynamic compromise?
It's because that electrical impulse is traveling slowly, muscle cell to muscle cell, through the ventricles. The contraction is disorganized and it's inefficient. That just tanks your stroke volume.
And the rapid rate on top of that makes the diastolic filling problem even worse.
It's a double hit to your cardiac output. And on top of all that, VT can degenerate into pulseless VT or ventricular fibrillation at any moment.
What are the primary ECG keys for recognizing VT?
The rate is fast and it's typically regular. The QRS complex is wide. And the P waves are either gone, you can't see them, or you can see them firing independently of the QRS. That's your AV dissociation again.
But the big clinical question you're often faced with in the moment is this really VT, or is it an SVT with aberrancy?
And that distinction, SVT with aberrancy versus VT, is one of the biggest, highest stakes pitfalls in peril. How do you tell them apart?
So how do we?
This is where you have to look for really nuanced findings. If it's an SVT that's just traveling down an already injured or blocked bundle patch, that's aberrancy, you can still sometimes see clues of its supraventricular origin.
Like some RR variability, or you might spot a P wave that does conduct every now and then.
Right. In true VT, you're looking for definitive signs of AV dissociation or things called fusion beats or capture beats, which are just more proof that the atria and ventricles are not talking.
But in the middle of a code, in that chaos, if you can't immediately tell the difference and the patient is unstable,
the PALS algorithm is crystal clear. If a wide complex tachycardia is causing hemodynamic compromise, you treat it as the most dangerous option. You treat it as VT until you can prove otherwise.
Because VT requires immediate electrical or pharmacological intervention.
Immediately.
Let's talk about the causes of VT. When you see that rhythm on the strip, what should the nurse be anticipating in terms of diagnostics?
When you see VT, it strongly suggests there's a severe underlying problem. It could be congenital heart disease, like long QT syndrome, or a significant cardiomyopathy or myocarditis.
Okay.
But crucially, from an ER perspective, you have to anticipate the need to treat severe electrolyte disturbances, hypokalemia, hyperkalemia, hypocalcemia, and drug toxicity.
Things like tricyclic antidepressants.
Tricyclics, methamphetamines. When you see a wide complex tachycardia, your immediate thought process should be, draw a chemistry panel and a toxicology screen right now.
Okay, finally, let's cover that visually distinct and highly dangerous variant of VT, polymorphic VT, or torsades de pointe.
Torsades is, it's visually unmistakable once you've seen it. The QRS complexes look like they're twisting or rotating around the isoelectric line. They change their polarity and their amplitude. That's where the name comes from, turning on a point.
And the rate is usually extremely fast and often irregular.
Very fast and very unstable.
What is the critical clinical association for torsades? What do we have to know?
You have to know that it is almost always associated with a prolonged QT interval in the patient's preceding sinus rhythm. This rhythm is extremely unstable and can degrade into V-fib in a heartbeat.
And this rhythm has a very specific pharmaceutical treatment that the ER nurse absolutely has to be ready for.
It does. The causes are often things like congenital long QT syndromes, hypomagnesemia, hypokalemia, or certain drug toxicities. And since low magnesium is such a common acquired cause, the specific intervention for torsades is often the immediate administration of magnesium sulfate.
Alongside defibrillation if they become pulseless.
Of course.
All right. We've laid out the foundational knowledge. We've gone through the ECG patterns. Here's where it gets really interesting. For that ER nurse who's prepping for PELS, how does mastering all these distinctions actually translate into running a successful, organized, and time-efficient resuscitation.
The power of accurate rhythm recognition is all about anticipation. It lets the nurse move beyond just waiting for an order and lets them start executing all the preparatory steps.
Like drawing up meds, setting up equipment.
Exactly. Drawing up meds, setting the defib parameters, gathering specific labs. You can do all of that simultaneously with the provider's assessment. And that saves seconds, and those seconds define outcomes.
Let's use a couple of concrete scenarios to really illustrate that rapid-fire decision process. Scenario one, a toddler comes in, heart rate is 170, they're hypotensive, mottled, and lethargic. The monitor shows wide, regular QRS complexes, no identifiable P waves.
Yeah, okay. Unstable, wide, complex tachycardia. We have to assume VT. So your immediate action, knowing how serious VT is to secure the ABCs, of course, but you're specifically anticipating the electrical and the toxicological interventions.
So you're confirming the pads are on.
You confirm the synchronized cardioversion pads are placed. You make sure the energy dose 0.5 to 1 joule per kilo to start is dialed in. And while you're putting in that IV, you are drawing immediate labs for potassium, magnesium, and a tox screen.
And you're already thinking about the meds.
You are proactively preparing an amiodarone or a lidocaine infusion. The rhythm on the monitor dictated all of those preparatory steps immediately.
Okay, scenario two. A six-month-old infant comes in with 104-degree fever. Heart rate is 210. It's regular narrow complex. The P waves are almost hidden. When the nurse goes to place an oral temp, the rate drops for just a second to 180 and then climbs right back up to 210.
Okay, that drop in rate, even if it was just transient, that's a subtle clue that there might be some variability. However, the rate is persistently close to that 220 threshold. The P waves are absent. Clinically, you cannot rule out SVT.
Especially since the signs of compromise can overlap so much with fever and sepsis.
You can't tell the difference sometimes. So the nurse's action has to be immediate preparation for an adenosine push and flush.
Let's detail that adenosine prep because the nursing technique is so crucial and so time sensitive.
It absolutely is. Adenosine has a half-life of just a few seconds, so the nurse has to establish two lines if possible or have everything ready at one. You need a proximal IV line for the rapid push of the adenosine, and you need a separate syringe ready for a rapid aggressive saline flush.
At least 5 to 10 millis.
At least. The medication has to be pushed as fast as you can, followed immediately by that flush, and you have to elevate the limb to get the drug to the central circulation before it metabolizes. If you recognize SVT, you are setting the sequence up while someone else is attempting vagal maneuvers.
Now, let's flip that. What if the heart rate was on 70? The child was screaming, the QRS was narrow, but the rate slowed down predictably every time they paused to take a breath.
That predictable variability and the fact that the rate is staying below that critical 180 or 220 threshold, that points very strongly to sinus tachycardia. And
your actions shift completely.
Completely. You hold the adenosine, you prioritize rapid temperature reduction antipyretics, maybe cooling blankets, and a fluid assessment. You anticipate the need for an IV fluid bolus to treat the dehydration that the fever caused. You're treating the cause, not the rhythm.
Let's connect bradycardia back to the bedside. You said symptomatic bradycardia is the pre-arrest state that's driven by hypoxia.
Right. And when you see that symptomatic bradycardia, that heart rate under 60 with poor perfusion, the nurse's ABC flow is absolutely non-negotiable. First thing is airway, oxygenation, and ventilation.
You have to max out their oxygen delivery.
You have to. You ensure maximum oxygen delivery and effective ventilation before you even think about rhythm drugs. If and only if that bradycardia persists despite good ventilation and 100% oxygen.
That is the trigger.
That is the clear trigger for the nurse to initiate CPR.
And what's the common pitfall here that the nurse has to avoid?
Wasting time waiting for medications. If you see a persistent bradycardia at 50 with poor perfusion, that child is effectively in cardiac arrest. CPR is what provides the artificial circulation they need to perfuse their own coronaries in their brain.
Trying to draw up atropine when the kid really just needs you to bag them better or start compressions is a critical delay.
It's a critical delay. Recognition dictates. Secure the airway first, then start compressions if the rate doesn't come up.
This entire discussion just reinforces that the PLS material, it's not just a sequence of boxes in an algorithm. It's a roadmap that's built on this underlying pathophysiology.
Oh, yes.
We have to master the differences between Mobitz type I and II, between ST and SVT variability, and between the wide versus the narrow QRS complex.
Exactly. And mastering that differentiation based on all the ECG characteristics we've discussed, that's the hardest part, but it's also the most impactful challenge. In the middle of all that chaos, the rhythm strip is your most objective piece of data.
It tells you what to do next.
It tells you whether you should be preparing fluids or synchronizing the electricity or checking the electrolytes. The question you have to ask yourself is, what stands out to you in that chaos? Is it the fixed, unrelenting pace of SVT? Or is it that subtle rate change of ST? That is the question that guides the entire code.
That distinction variability versus a fixed rate, that really is the mental cornerstone for managing pediatric tachycardias.
It is.
That was an incredibly detailed deep dive into the foundations of PEL arrhythmia recognition. It was really tailored for the ER nurse. Let's recap the four most critical takeaways that you need to internalize for your next shift.
Okay, number one, physiological constraint. Always remember that heart rate is the primary driver of cardiac output in infants and young kids.
Right.
Any significant deviation is immediately life-threatening.
Number two.
Bradycardia priority. Symptomatic bradycardia, that heart rate less than 60 with compromise, is almost always secondary to hypoxia. Your first action is to secure the airway and maximize ventilation. If it persists, start CPR immediately.
Number three, the big one.
Tachycardia differentiation. You must be able to swiftly tell the difference. Is it sinus tachycardia, which is a normal response that has rate variability and a rate generally below 220 or 180? Or is it SVT or VT, a pathological rhythm with a fixed relentless rate that often meets or exceeds those thresholds?
And finally, number four.
Wide complex warning. Ventricular tachycardia is high risk. Recognizing a wide QRS complex should immediately alert you to the possibility of underlying heart disease, toxicology, or severe electrolyte problems like with potassium or magnesium.
This foundational knowledge, it really does transform you from someone who's just following orders into a proactive clinical leader who can anticipate that next step.
We really encourage you to practice applying these ECG characteristics and these differentiators mentally. Don't just memorize the treatments. Understand why a certain rhythm leads to a specific treatment. Keep those PR intervals, QRS widths, and RR variability cues at the top of your mind as you move on to mastering the specific PILE algorithms.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into PILE's foundations. We wish you the very best in your preparation and, of course, in your practice.
Until next time.